Welcome to the Glyndebourne podcast. I'm Peggy Reynolds, and I'll be exploring the theatrical and musical history behind one of the earliest English operas, Henry Purcell's The Faerie Queen. Henry Purcell's The Faerie Queen was first performed at the Queen's Theatre, Dorset Garden, in the spring of 1692. This theatre had only been built fairly recently, and it was one of the many that went up in London in the wake of the Restoration some 30 years before. The design was a wedding cake concoction with large windows on the first floor where theatregoers could see and be seen. Young Henry Purcell would not have been able to remember the time when Puritan restrictions had darkened all the London stages. He was born, probably in 1659, right at the end of the interregnum. His father had sung at the coronation of Charles II a year later in 1660. But, like his father and his uncle, he was a musician, and he benefited from the revival of the theatres. During the relatively quiet reigns of Charles II, then James II, and now William and Mary, fashionable people wanted to forget the drab austerity of the past. Wigs grew taller, gowns grew broader, and places to go where you could display your finery grew up apace. But what was the audience expecting from a night out at the theatre in 1692? Professor Lisa Jardine of Queen Mary, University of London.
I really think that what you could expect from a night at a Purcell opera was Glyndebourne. Absolutely everybody, done up to the nines, slightly looking at one another to see who was better got up, who'd got the better picnic. It's a wonderfully, flamboyantly enthusiastic, appreciative audience of a theatre which you know is going to give you absolutely all the bells and whistles, absolutely every kind of contrivance that was possible in the contemporary theatre, and the best voices and the best music and the best dancing.
At the end of the 17th century, the English theatre-going public were open to experiment. They liked a story, but they wanted to be moved, and it was music that could do that. As David Pickard, General Director of Glyndebourne, explains, the Faerie Queen has a peculiar place in the history of the operatic repertoire.
In many ways, of course, the Faerie Queen isn't an opera at all. It's listed as a semi-opera, and it comes out of a tradition of opera that was still being formulated. It was presented less than 100 years after the very first opera. And the origins of opera came from a number of different sources to do with masque, to do with dance, to do with singing, to do with orchestral playing. It was still in its infancy as an art form. And in a way, one of the fascinating things about the Faerie Queen is it shows an early version of people experimenting with what opera is and what it could be in the future.
Are the sentries set?
They are.
Tis well. If any mortal dare approach this spot of fairy ground, blind the wretch, then turn him round, three times turn, then bring him in. About him gamble, dance and sing, pinch his arms, his thighs, his shins. Pinch till he confess his sins.
In the case of the Faerie Queen, Purcell's librettist took Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream as the basic story, and that is spoken dialogue performed by actors. So this is the plot we all know, with the misunderstandings between the four young Athenian lovers, with the quarrel between Oberon and Titania, and with Titania's unfortunate love for the absurdly translated bottom wearing an ass's head. Today, of course, A Midsummer Night's Dream is one of the most popular of Shakespeare's plays, but that was not always the case. Lisa Jardine.
We all rather love A Midsummer Night's Dream. Most of us did it at school. Many of us performed in it. The period post-Restoration and into the reign of William and Mary didn't think much of A Midsummer Night's Dream. We know that Samuel Pepys thought it was not an interesting play and a bit dull. So Purcell is not altogether interested in the plot of A Midsummer Night's Dream. And his librettist, although it's really more like a scriptwriter, plays fast and loose with the play. And the play is really a vehicle for wonderful masque-like interludes, balletic interludes, wonderful operatic solos and duets and ensembles, which, quite frankly, in the end make you not worry all that much about the plot of what in the end is quite a silly play.
Let us have all variety of music, all that should welcome up the rising sun.
Andrew Pinnock, musicologist and honorary secretary of the Purcell Society, sees how the idea of using Shakespeare's play was ideal for the purposes of a spectacular operatic production.
Semi-operas, by the standards of the day, were enormously expensive undertakings. £2,000-£3,000 was the upfront investment required in The Faerie Queen. Risky. If you put the wrong piece on, if the play chosen isn't a robust vehicle for music, then you won't get your money back. So almost all the late 17th century semi-operas were revivals, adapted revivals of earlier plays.
So while Shakespeare's story provides a plotline, the music for The Faerie Queen wraps interludes and songs around the action. This is the masque part of the performance, and it involves singers and dancers. We don't know who wrote the librettos for these songs, although it may have been the actor-manager Thomas Betterton, who specialised in restoration spectaculars. There were instrumental pieces at the beginning for the audience to take their seats, and act tunes, played partly to make division in the scenes, because unlike now the curtain did not come down in the intervals, and partly to let the audience go about the business of enjoying themselves. Lisa Jardine.
It required an enormous amount of stamina. These events are extraordinarily long. I imagine that unlike the nicely behaved audiences that you have at contemporary operas, that the audience came in, went off and had dinner, came back and it was still going on. I really find it hard to imagine that they sat through the whole thing. They weren't very disciplined, these people.
On stage, however, there would have been a great deal of professionalism and brilliant opportunities for actors, singers and dancers. And this included many prominent women.
Every schoolchild knows that there were no women in Shakespeare's plays, that there were no women on the English stage in the age of Shakespeare. However, women did act in the court masques of James I, so they were on the royal stage. And at the Restoration, they came in a major dramatic way as queens of the new Restoration theatre. So by the time of The Faerie Queen, your prima donnas are really that. They are prima donnas. And although Titania, of course, in the original performance, was played by a child, so the prima donnas are the solo singers, in the play, the king and queen were played by children.
In The Faerie Queen, the spectacular effects of the theatre are subservient to a kind of Enlightenment rationalism, in that all of the masque-like music and ballet episodes are conjured up by the fairies or linked to the more enchanted supernatural events in the story. So in Act 3, when Titania has fallen in love with Bottom in his ass's head, they lie down to sleep in a scented grove, while a nymph serenades them. Given that this is a theatrical spectacular, it has to include something for everyone. No sooner has the nymph finished with her serious aria than there follows a comic episode, sort of, on the same topic. The shepherd Coridon and his girlfriend Mopsa are stock characters from the pastoral tradition. In the first production, Mopsa was cast as a soprano. But in a later revival, Purcell noted that it was to be performed by Mr. Pate in Woman's Habit. The countertenor voice was familiar in the theatre of the 17th century, but clearly audiences at the time appreciated the pantomime possibilities of cross-dressing just as much as we do today.
Oh, the maids and the men are making their way. We've left the dull fools, we've left the dull fools and are stolen away. Then Mopsa no more, be coy as before, but let's merrily, 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 merrily play. And kiss, and kiss, and kiss, and kiss, and kiss the sweet time away.
Why, hello,
Sir Clown, why, hello, what makes you so bold? I'm happy, no, I'm not playing of that mold. I tell you again, again and again, mates must never kiss no man. No, 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 no kissing at all. No, 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 no kissing at all. I won't kiss till I kiss you for good and all.
In Act 4 of The Faerie Queene, one of the most extended masks comes after Titania has been released from the spell and is reunited with Oberon. All the fairies celebrate his birthday, and he is praised as Phoebus, the sun god.
Let the fight and the clatter, let the fight and the clatter, let the fight and the clatter, and the clatter.
All of this Act 4 mask is, as Lisa Jardine explains, an elaborate compliment to the influence of the king, William of Orange, and his wife, Mary.
The watershed moment in British history that really places Purcell's Faerie Queene is the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Indeed, the end of 1688, so not actually all that long before 1692, when this opera was first performed. In 1688, William of Orange of the Netherlands and his wife, Mary Stuart, daughter of James II, invaded Britain. James II abdicated, and a totally new regime took over the British Isles. I think it's quite hard for us to realise how dramatic the change was from the Stuarts, James I with his court masks, Charles I with his opulent court, Charles II, again, opulence and glorious extravagance. And now, after a couple of years of the Catholic James, a Protestant revolution doesn't mean that the opulence goes away, but it means there's a more intensely British feeling about the British Isles.
At this time, the growth of trade and industry and the beginnings of empire meant that the financial wherewithal was there to sustain and support that new sense of Britishness and British pride.
So one of the things that William and Mary brought to London was money. The whole of the Stuart dynasty had run on debt, and all of its extravagance was slightly tense. William brought a lot of the Dutch coffers with him. The Bank of England was founded. Dutch tax money came in and loosened up the royal exchequer. So what you get in London in the 1690s is a real feeling of over-the-top glamour. And Purcell is part of that, a kind of unashamedly, almost Thatcherite years, the glamour of Britain, the spending of money, long theatre pieces with huge casts, and every bit of music and dance you could possibly, spectacle you could possibly have.
In the fifth and final act of The Faerie Queene, Theseus is told of the lovers' misadventures in the wood, and everyone is allowed to marry the right person. Juno, Queen of the Gods, and Hymen, Goddess of Marriage, appear to celebrate the weddings. But again, there is a compliment to William and Mary in this mask. A Chinese man and a Chinese woman celebrate the joys of freedom in connubial bliss. It refers not only to the anniversary of William and Mary's marriage, but to Mary's famous collection of blue and white Chinese porcelain, some of which is still in the royal collection today. The Gentleman's Journal for 1692 declared that the Fairy Queen is very entertaining and that the court and the town were wonderfully satisfied with it. One wit composed a little couplet. Shakespeare's Sublime in vain enticed the throng without the charm of Purcell's siren song. Lisa Jardine.
Purcell's A Fairy Queen was first performed in 1692, was a huge success. He was already a celebrity, and this confirmed his celebrity status. And it was absolutely to the Queen's taste. It went along with all her exotic interests, and it even included references to her love of exotica, Chinese porcelain, and the things that she collected at Kensington Palace. Mary died in 1694, and that seems to mark the end of this kind of period of exuberant affluence and celebrity that had marked the years of her reign. From then on, William's is a much more political and austere reign.
Henry Purcell himself died a year later at the early age of 35. Some say that he caught a chill after returning home late one night to find that his wife had locked him out. Others that he died of chocolate poisoning. The music that he had so recently composed for Mary's funeral was used at his own. He was buried in Westminster Abbey, where his epitaph reads, "Here lies Henry Purcell, Esquire, who left this life and is gone to that blessed place where only his harmony can be exceeded." After his death, his wife Frances published a number of his works, but the score for The Faerie Queene was mysteriously lost. Andrew Pinnock.
The score of The Faerie Queene, a partial autograph, was lost in 1695. In late 1694, the United Company of Actors that commissioned The Faerie Queene broke up very acrimoniously. Some ran off to another theatre and theatrical competition re-erupted. Purcell, of course, died in 1695. It's likely that the score of the Faerie Queen was stolen in order to prevent the formerly United Company from mounting revivals and recouping its huge investment. From a modern perspective, it seems strange that there was only one copy of the score of the Faerie Queen, but we know there was only one. A number of advertisements were placed in newspapers offering a £50 reward for the return of the score of the Faerie Queen, without which it was unperformable. The score wasn't returned. A number of chancers attempted to claim it by copying out things they said were the score, reference to bits of the Faerie Queen that had been published, but they didn't manage to reassemble anything complete. It reappeared around 1900 in the library of the Royal Academy of Music. One wonders quite what cataloguing policies the Academy had been following in the decades previously. It was there safely from the mid-19th century, but no one realised until the original Purcell Society edition was in preparation. And of course, it's wonderful to have the score back. No other Purcell semi-opera is remotely as well preserved.
And so, a happy ending all round for the Faerie Queen. And indeed for Glyndebourne, because in the opinion of David Pickard, this is a piece especially suited to the Glyndebourne Festival.
I think there is something slightly mad about the piece. There's no question about that at all. It is a sort of a hodgepodge of different things pulled together, and it is a deeply eccentric piece. And I think you would have to say that Glyndebourne is an eccentric place. So somehow there is a sort of meeting of both that particular piece and the surroundings in which people exist here. And in a funny sort of way, just as we break our performance in the middle for 90 minutes to have our supper interval, I have no doubt that audiences in the Haymarket would slip out for a bite to eat or a pint of beer somewhere in the middle of that performance and dip back in again. So I think there is a natural synergy between the piece and the place.
Pints and picnics notwithstanding, the Faerie Queen contains some of Purcell's most alluring music, and that is the real draw. Let me leave you with an aria that can compare with Purcell's famous Remember Me for Dido and Aeneas. This is Let Me Weep from Act 5 of The Faerie Queen.